underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When Stefan Gerson's 8-year-old son Owen died in a rafting accident, he found himself in uncharted territory. In the weeks that followed, he started to write about life without his son. Eventually, those writings took shape as the new book, Disaster Falls, A Family Story. As Stefan navigates his grief, the memoir expands to explore how society reacts to the death of a child. It explores how stories can both memorialize and obscure a person's life, and how they can rescue us. Again, the name of the memoir is Disaster Falls, A Family Story, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Stefan Gerson to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Glad to be here.
At what point did you start to think that not only was this something that you wanted to explore through your writing, but it would be something that you would want to share with others?
I'd say maybe 3 or 4 years after my son died. I'd been writing, you know, incessantly, compulsively after he died, journaling constantly every day, accumulating a lot of material, a lot of notes, so kind of a chronicle, everyday chronicle of our lives. And about 3-4 years afterwards, I decided that maybe I would shape this into a story.
Describe a little bit the compulsiveness of that writing, of how that became your impulse to want to take pen to paper and to write.
Yeah, it began 2 weeks after the funeral. I went to my office one day. I wasn't quite sure, you know, why I went there, but I just picked up my computer and I started journaling, writing about what I was feeling, what I was observing around me. And that I kept doing that for 4 years. Every day I would be writing. Even when I went back to work, I constantly had 2 files open on my computer. And this writing became a form of observation of myself, observation of what I saw within the house, in the family, in my wife and my other son and other relatives, and observation of what I saw in the broader world. I had a sense that everything around me and within me had been changing so fast and so radically, and I was trying to both record it and try to understand it.
Was that helpful for you in the grieving process? Aside from the writing, the idea of processing the grief, was that helpful?
In retrospect, yes. I mean, at the time, it felt like something that I could not control. It wasn't something that was willful. Mm. It was almost a force that took hold of me and that I kind of observed. A lot of the writing, both at that point and later when I started writing the book, felt like something necessary, something indispensable for myself and perhaps for others, and I kind of succumbed to it.
You talk in the book about in the days, weeks, months, and years after of what people would say to you. And I assume in most cases people are trying to help, obviously. But it is that idea of trying to get a handle on the unfathomable.
Yeah, the question of language is a fascinating one. I mean, the loss of a child is so huge. Mm. You know, in our society, I mean, look at the movies, look at books, look at plays. I mean, the loss of a child recurs constantly as a signifier of the worst thing possible, especially in the world in which we live, which is so child-centric. And so when a child dies, it kind of captures some of our deepest fears, and it pushes, I think, at the limits of a language. What do you say? How do you put it into words? What do you say to the parent who is dealing with this? I think there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of uncertainty. Both, I felt it both from the outside, but also within myself. And perhaps my writing was also a way for me to try to find a language to make sense of something that felt so huge.
And there is that outside language that you use with others, but even within your marriage, of what to say and when to say it, and navigating that territory,
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the question, of course, of how a couple grieves for a child is a complicated one. My wife Allison and I both grieve in very different ways, and a big part of the grief I felt was learning about oneself, about how one grieves, about who one is as one grieves, but also about the other. And as you know, weeks became months, and months became years. We changed. We became different people to some extent, and we had to think about how to rethink and reconfigure our marriage, given that we were not the same people anymore. And language, how we communicate and what we say to one another, was a big part of that.
Because if there is such a thing as a rule of thumb in regards to tragedies like this, is that a marriage seldom survives the death of a child.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's an urban myth. I mean, I read about this, and certainly a lot of people would tell us that.
Sure.
Some people very explicitly come to you and, wow, you guys are still together. 90% of marriages fail after the loss of a child. And that's part, I think, of the kind of cultural representations that we have of the loss of a child. It's so huge that a marriage is going to be kind of strained and collapse. I'm not sure there's been enough work, enough studies, none that I've found, that can give you specific numbers. Mm. But it certainly was part of the kind of the images that we had, my wife Allison and I, and that others had around us, that a marriage is going to be tested and may well not survive. So we have to deal with these images, and it's a reality. There are for sure serious tests.
And was it something conscious where you said, okay, this is what we want to work through this. We don't want that to happen.
Yeah, I think we were very much aware of that to some degree. To some degree, you can anticipate and you can take steps. And we start seeing a couples therapist together very early on. Allison insisted on that, and I think that was a really good idea. So that every week we had at least 1 hour in which we would communicate, we would talk. But both of us, you know, do believe in communication and sharing, and we did try to talk and express things. And over time, sometimes you can't talk. Sometimes you can't help out the other. Sometimes you see your partner in pain or at a loss, and you don't have the answer, and you don't have much to give. Other times it's easier. But there are moments where you feel yourself at a loss, not only in terms of navigating the pain and the sorrow and the uncertainty, but in terms of how to help your spouse.
You make that point several times in the book, which I loved, actually, that sometimes there just is nothing to say, and that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's both true within the marriage and with others.
Sure.
I mean, you asked about other people, what people could say. I felt, I mean, there were two things. I mean, either just being present, constantly present, remaining present. You're right, without talking, but just being your physical presence is big. Or else speaking honestly about the loss, just putting simple words to exactly what happened can be very powerful, because it makes the bereaved feel less alone, and it kind of confirms also the enormity of what he or she is going through.
Stefan Gerson is our guest. The name of the new book is Disaster Falls, A Family Story. It is published by Crown. Talk a little bit about Owen's death in the sense of what happened. I mean, one of the ironic things, of course, is that Disaster Falls is the name of the area in which you were rafting where he perished. So it had a reputation, right?
Well, it was a historical place. It's a set of rapids on the Green River in Colorado, just next to the border with Utah. In 1869, the first expedition to discover this part of Colorado, led by Powell, ran into problems there, and they lost the boat. They didn't lose any human lives, but they lost the boat, and they gave it the name Disaster Falls. I'm a historian by training, and yet I knew nothing about that. Right. This was an organized trip, a four-day trip. This was the first day of the trip, the afternoon of that trip. It was a trip open to families with children 7 and older. I had read the instructions, but I had not studied the history of those rapids. So one of the ways in which I responded to Owen's death and when the way in which I grieved was to delve into the past. And I researched to some degree the history of Disaster Falls to understand what was the nature of this place and what were some of the historical factors that may have explained what happened that day. I mean, I kind of revisit that day from many different angles, and history was certainly one of them. And it's true that over the years there have been a number of accidents there.
And there's a point where you can do that, I assume. I mean, is there a point where you're ready to do something like that? Did you go back?
No, I never went back physically. It was through books and articles that I did this research. Yeah.
Even that idea, though, even from a distance, is there a point where you feel, okay, I am ready, I am not ready to do this thing or that thing?
You mean in terms of getting closer to the spot?
And looking at the history and looking at, as you say, there were many angles. So are there points where you sort of allow yourself to say, okay, I'm ready for this, I'll wait for that?
Yeah, it was a progressive process. I think that for me, going back physically, looking at pictures was extremely difficult. So that kind of visual, visceral connection to the place was often more than I could handle. But retrieving the history was something that was more familiar to me. It was something that's like, as a historian, I'm used to that kind of language, that kind of practice. And so in a way, rewriting this history, understanding this history, was a process in which I both went closer in terms of gaining knowledge, but at the same time gained a distance by situating within a broader historical framework.
3 years after your son died, your father passed. And that plays a role in this as well. Talk a little bit about the death of your father and how Owen's passing worked into your dealing with that situation.
Right. So my dad was 81. After Owen died, he was very present, but he had a hard time talking about Owen. He had a hard time dealing with his own grief, his own emotions, and after a while, he refused to talk about him at all. He refused to even hear his name or to see pictures of Owen, which was very difficult for me to be in his presence and to be unable to talk about my son or to even hear mention of my son, even though I knew that it came from a place of hurt. This was difficult, and I felt that as I grieved for my son, this was such uncharted territory for all of us. That in some way I took on the parental mantle, that I was kind of leading the way. My parents were present, as was my father, but they didn't know anything more than I did. We're all kind of figuring it out. And because my father was not talking about Owen, I felt to some degree that he was no longer there as my father, that he was no longer to kind of protect, to set a course, to provide models about how to go on with life. And it's really only at the end of his life, in the last days of his life, that rather surprisingly, he reemerged as a father.
What is it like to question fatherhood while you still have another child to be a father to?
So we have two sons. We Owen, who was 8 at the time of the accident, and Julian, who was 11, becoming a teenager. In the years that followed the accident, I revisited the accident, what I had done that day, what I could have done, what could have been different. And that led to a sort of crisis of authority, a crisis of confidence as well. You know, what do I have to offer to my sons? Can I still protect my children? I mean, these were deep questions, and these questions very much colored my relationship with Julian during the years that followed. And, what can I tell him? With what authority can I speak to him? These were complicated issues.
You were looking for stories. Stories were important to you. How so, and what type of stories were important to you in this process?
Some of the stories I was looking for were stories of other people who had lost children. So I went back to the past, and I found writings by writers and poets like Victor Hugo or Du Bois and others who wrote very evocatively about losing their children. And these men and women from the past, some famous, others not, were always available to me. Whenever I needed some companionship in my grief, I felt that they were there for me and that we could grieve together. So there was a sense of looking to other stories of grief in the past. But as I wrote, I realized that there was also a need within myself, which I hadn't fully understood at the start, to write my own story, to write a story about how I and how a family overcomes this kind of loss. And the pull of this story was very strong as well, especially once after I decided to take this journal and turn it into a memoir.
So it becomes a response to the loss.
I felt that by framing these events into a narrative, mm-hmm. That would enable me to somehow encompass it, to somehow maybe not make sense of it, but at least situate it within a kind of framework that was comprehensible to me and that I could take with me as I move forward with Owen and with my memories of him.
One of the things that you deal with in the book, which I found fascinating, and you do it beautifully, is how we as a culture, as a society, as individuals deal with death.
Mm-hmm.
We're not very good at it, are we? And especially when you add in the death of a child.
I think that I can talk about the death of a child. I think that, as I said, it does... It pushes at the limits of our understanding. It pushes at the limits of our language. I think that we don't have many models about how to talk about this, how to behave with people who are grieving. I think there's a lot of fear, a lot of misconceptions as well about it. And one of the things I try to do with this book was to demystify, to write as honestly, as completely as I could about one family's experiences. Sometimes I felt that the closer I could come to what I went through and to what my wife and my son and our family went through, the closest I could come to it, the less it would be about us specifically, and the more it would be about what happens to one family within our culture today.
Do you think, though, that it, because it did, in my reading of the story, it opened up my thoughts as to my own mortality, of just death in general, which, as I said earlier, I don't know that we're terrifically good at of thinking about that, and there is a fear that is inherent, and thereby we don't think about it and plan for it as perhaps we should.
We certainly don't talk about it much,
right.
Or if we talk about it, if you look at the arts or media, or it tends to be in terms of tropes that are not always very honest about dying. And there, perhaps, the death of my father was actually quite important because he died of cancer in Belgium, and assisted dying is legal there, and that is what he chose at the end of his life. And my father was someone who never spoke about death, whom I was pretty much assumed was afraid of dying and lived as if he would not die. Once he made a decision to control his own death in the last 3 days of his life, he hadn't talked about it that much before, but once he made that decision, he became capable of speaking about death, of accepting death, of opening himself to the end of his life, and of sharing that with me and my sister and the rest of our family. And watching him do that, watching him not embrace death, but accept it and live to the last minutes of his life with this acknowledgement of life and death was very, very meaningful to me.
You are told by someone that if a child loses a parent, they are an orphan, but there is no word for a parent who loses a child. Were you ever searching for a word?
No, I wasn't searching for a word. I was searching for the language to render the experience as honestly as I could. And what I found is that the way to do this was to pare down the language, was to be as simple as economical in describing and rendering the very deep and multifaceted experience we went through. So that by paring down language, I think, my goal at least, was to allow the emotion and the multiple responses and forms of behavior that I saw around me to really come alive.
Our guest on the book show this week is Stefan Gerson. He is a cultural historian and a professor of French studies at New York University. His new memoir is Disaster Falls, A Family Story. It is published by Crown. So here's an impossible question to answer, but I'll ask it anyway, which is, if you read this book in 10 years, how do you think you'll feel?
That's a good question. I think that this book will stay with me as a touchstone. I sometimes fantasize about what rereading this book will represent and whether I want to continue immersing myself in it. The writing of the book was incredibly powerful. It was not difficult. It was demanding, but there was that connection with my son and with that moment in time, a moment during which people reveal things about themselves, a moment during which the emotions were so strong, and there was a clarity about what other people were feeling as well. And so I'd like to think that in 10 years, by rereading the book, I will be able to touch that moment and to connect with my son as I do today.
I don't want to give anything away. There is a bit of a surprise ending to the book, and so that's the teaser for people to go out and to read it. But was it a decision to include it in the story? Did you always know that was going to be a part of it?
Actually, when I started writing, I had no idea where it would end. And then life took a turn. And then it became clear that if I wanted to remain honest to our story, as I sought to do, if I want to include all dimensions of our lives after Owen died, I could not leave it out. So at that point, it became a pretty easy decision.
How much, even though it is you writing, how much is your wife in the writing with you as to what you tell and how you tell it?
Right. When I decided to write, to turn this into a book, the first thing I did was I went to my wife, Allison, and I said, "Are you okay with this? I'm going to write about myself. I'm going to write about our family. I'm going to write about you. And it's going to be you as seen through my eyes. You won't be a fictional character, but you'll be a representation by me." And she said, yes. She says, go ahead. And so when, as I wrote the book, she never asked she never asked me any questions. She never expressed any doubts. And when I was finished with the first draft, she was the first to read it. And she didn't request any changes or any cuts. And I think that the trust that she gave me, the trust that I could render our story as honestly as I could, and that I could render her in a way that was true to who she was huge. I think it was a sign of love, and it played a big part in my own recovery from this loss.
Stefan Gerson is a cultural historian and a professor of French studies at New York University. He is the author of the new book, Disaster Falls, A Family Story. It is published by Crown. Stefan, thank you so much for being with us and sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program Bookmarkus for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.